So obviously moving on from the ground, in respect to your time as chairman and obviously the club now, and we've discussed this about the Premier League, the differences are immeasurable. In terms of player contracts and negotiating transfers back then, is there anything memorable that comes to mind? I've been told by a few people that the Bobby Zamora story, for example, is one that we need to hear. And how have things changed now, would you say, or how did they change during the whole time?
Well, the principles haven't changed at all. It's just, instead of noughts, there are commas.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but the principles haven't changed. So what happened with Bobby Zamora, and it was, you know, utmost respect for Bobby because he was a great pro and he was a great player. But what happened, Mickey Adams and I, basically what happened, we were going to see another player that we were going to sign. And I always, you know, when the manager, I mean, I didn't tell the manager you've got to sign this player or whatever, but I was always involved in when we were, you know, thinking about signing a player. And this gangling kid was playing for the other team, for the player that I was watching. And I said to Mickey, you know, keep an eye, that guy looks useful to me. Keep an eye on him, get the scouts to keep an eye on him. Which they did, and to cut a long story short, we got him in on loan, because he was at Bristol Rovers. He's a London boy, but he was at Bristol Rovers and he'd never played in their first team. Anyway, he came here on loan for a month, and he scored 6 goals in 6 games.
Amazing.
So we, including a hat-trick away from home, right, which doesn't happen very often. So we obviously said stay, you know, because you could keep them for 3 months. That's how the loan system worked. You have them for a month or 2 months or 3 months. So we said, well, stay for the rest of the season. Bobby said, no, I'm going back to my club. They obviously will have noticed that I've scored 6 goals. And this is what I mean about him being a true professional. He said, I need to go back to Bristol Rovers and honour my contract there and hopefully I'll get a chance in the first team. He didn't. So he sat out the rest of that season, 2 months, warming the bench, or even not even on the bench. So at the end of the season, I said to Mickey, I'm going to bid for this player. You know, we've got to get him. So I originally offered 60 grand for him, which was a huge amount of money for us in those days. And they said, the chairman, who I got to know very well, Jeff Dunscombe, said, no, we want $250,000, Dick, for him. So I said, what do you mean? What they had a succession of strikers at Bristol Rovers who all, you know, they found them, either they came through the ranks or they found them. And they were regularly selling centre-forward strikers for that sort of money. So that he just assumed he could get $250,000 for Zamora, and though Zamora wasn't even in the first team. So I said, don't be ridiculous, Jeff. You know, what I'm going to do is offer you £100,000. And I didn't have to consult the board because I'd already said we're going to go for him. Everyone said, we've got to get this player. All the board agreed, you know, we should get it. Or try and get him. Anyway, he said, the figure is 250,000. So I said, forget it.
Yeah.
I said to Mickey Adams, don't worry, during the close season, so we're going into the close season now, everyone's going off on holiday. I said, he'll come back to me and accept. You know, he'll come to us. You know, we go all through the close season. The players come back for pre-season training, no contact from Bristol Rovers at all. So it gets to, we play one, I don't know if you remember this, we used to play one friendly a season before the season started at the Withdean, right? So we play this game against Notts Forest, who were actually in the Premier League at that time. And we drew with them, and Gary Hart, you know, who Mickey did not want to play at centre forward, but he wanted to play him wide on the right, And he and so Gary scored these two goals against Des Walker, who was the England international centre-half. And he said, great, Dick, I'm going to have to play Gary at centre-forward because whatever happened to Zamora. So I said to Mick, I swear to God, if I hadn't heard from them on Monday morning, this is the week before the season started, I will phone them. I will phone them, which is a big disadvantage because once you know, the initiative is with them. 10 o'clock on the Monday morning, the phone goes. It's the Bristol Rovers chairman. He says, are you still interested in Bobby Zamora? So I'm going like that. And I said, I don't know whether we are or not. I said, I'll have to speak to my manager, yeah. You know, playing dumb. I'm not sure whether he's moved on now, Jeff. So I said, give me 10 minutes and I'll see whether he's still interested. But of course, I never phoned him because I knew he'd be biting my hand off. Anyway, so I go back to him, to the chairman of Bristol, and I said, yeah, he still wants to give him a try, the lad. So he said, well, the price is still the same, Dick, 250,000. I said, don't wait, what are you... I did my nut, really.
Yeah.
I mean, only, you know, because I said, don't try it on, Jeff. I'm prepared to pay you £100,000, and that's the figure. And then he said, well, I'm not even sure we want to sell him. I said, well, why are you phoning me up then? He said, because the manager, who's Ian Holloway, thinks he'll never make it as a striker, but he could be a left-side midfield player. So I said, Jeff, can I speak to your manager? You know, so anyway, he said, I'll get him to ring you. So 10 minutes later, Ian Holloway ring. Oh, Dick, you know, this lovely Bristol accent that he's got. And he said, that young Zamora, he said, I know Mickey's quite interested in him. He said, but I think he's going to be a left-sided midfield player. I said, well, my manager, you know, you guys, you're all different. You've all got different views. I said, Mickey thinks he's going to be a striker. No. And we would really, does he figure in your, in every team has to have a squad. There's a maximum, it was 25 players at that time. It's now gone down a bit in those leagues. He said, well, I'm not sure whether he's even going to make the squad. I said, well, then, Ian, look, I've offered your club £100,000. It will give you money to buy another player. Let us give the boy a chance. So he says, oh, all right.
Oh, fair play to him.
So that's how I got Zamora. And, well, he got 93 goals in 3 seasons.
Yeah.
That's how good he was.
Yeah. He was fantastic. And you sold him to...
Spurs.
Was it 4 million?
No. Less than that. 1.5 million. Because what happened, I asked him and his dad, because his dad was very influential in his decision making. He had an agent, but he listened to his dad more. And I said to them both, you need to have a season in the Championship. Because we've gone... You know, on the back of Bobby's goals and the fact we had a decent team, we won League Two and then we won League One the following year. So we went from the fourth level to the second level in 2 years. Mm. And I said, you will play for England. I'm certain of that. And you will play in the Premier League. But you a year in the Championship will be really good for you because the level is much higher and it will be good for your... It's like to complete your apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Agreed, you know, because what happened, Everton came in during that close season and offered me £3.5 million for it. Bill Kenwright, the owner of Everton at that time, chairman, he's still the chairman, he offered me £3.5 million and I turned it down because I said, I've already, you know, my player, I'll tell them about it, but we've already agreed that he's not going anywhere. He's going to stay at Brighton this coming season. And, you know, they knew about this Everton move, but I was very polite about it, but turned it down. And in the end, I because his agent was getting involved, he wanted to get him to Spurs. And Glenn Hoddle, who's the manager of Spurs, because they were playing on a lot of their league games on Sundays because they were in the Europa Cup, so they played Thursdays and Sundays. He was at with Dean virtually every week. You know, so I almost gave him a season ticket, Glenn, because he was there watching Zamora. And so in the end, you know, he went. I had to deal with Daniel Levy, which was not pleasant. You know, he's a tough guy to deal with.
Yeah.
He felt he was doing me a favour, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, you're not doing me any favour. In fact, you should be paying a lot more for this player. But he's done a great job for me and for our club. And I owe it to Bobby to go to one of the top clubs. And so, you know, I'll agree this figure, which is way below what I thought I really should have got. But Bobby, you know, the irony was Hoddle got sacked in the September. In other words, only 2 months into the season, and Bobby got frozen out immediately because Levy didn't reckon him really.
Mm.
So once Hoddle had got sacked, Hoddle thought the world of him because he knew what a footballer he was.
Yeah.
I mean, but chairmen normally don't understand about football. They don't understand the quality of football. They don't understand the game itself.
You owed it to Bobby for him to go to a big club, but they were all busy, so he went end up at Spurs. That's what I would have said to Daniel Levy at the time.
Yeah. I would have been much happier if he'd gone to Arsenal or West Ham, both of which clubs I really like. You know, but Spurs were different. They were just awkward to deal with, unpleasant. They were doing me a favour. You know,
they seem to be like that now when you read about them in the papers, and he's still, obviously, Daniel Levy's still there and in charge, and everything with the stadium. They got rid of Pochettino, and they've got Mourinho in now. Marriage made in heaven, that, Mourinho and Levy. I mean, that's going to end in tears. So, obviously, you said that you dealt with Bobby Zamora's dad more than his agent. Now, I've got a question here, you know. We're dealing in the world now of so-called mega agents. I mean, agents that are getting paid millions. They're billionaires, some of these agents. At your time, how significant were agents?
How active were agents in my day? As active as they are now.
Really?
Yeah. When I took over at Brighton, I couldn't believe, you know, that even all the young players had agents. You know, even the boys that are just, 16, 17-year-olds who got their first professional contract, virtually all of them had agents. And here's an observation about football agents. Virtually all of them, when you first meet them, say, "I'm not like other agents, Dick."
And of course, lawyers.
And then proceed to demonstrate that they're exactly like all. But it just shows you they've got an inbuilt inferiority complex because they know everyone hates them. You know, it's like bookmakers or, you know, estate agents.
Yeah.
You know, it was always when someone said, "I should just make it clear to you, Dick, I am not like your average agent." I went, "Well, I'll be the judge of that when I finish dealing with you."
But obviously you've got to ask a question here about solicitors' involvement. I mean, how did solicitors get involved in players? Did the agent have the contract? Did it go to lawyers? How did the contracts for players get negotiated and finalised?
Well, a lot of the agents were associated with lawyers, law firms. And I think that is still the same today, because it makes sense, because you've got contracts being drafted with people who, you know, have a vested interest in the player and the player's welfare, rather than going to a separate... I mean, not all agents had law firms in association with them, but a lot of the big agents did. And so they worked in harness with them. So they were very instrumental in drafting out a proposal. But, you know, don't forget that in the EFL, certainly, which we were in when I was there, there is a standard contract And there's only the, you know, the schedule of the contract is where it's flexible to put in the various terms, the special terms of
the bonuses, goal bonuses,
whatever. Yeah, image rights. But the basic contract is was drawn up, you know, by the in agreement with the PFA and the Premier League and the EFL. I think the Premier League now has a slightly different contract, but it's based on the same. So the basic structure of the contract is, you know, fully developed by legal people. It's the schedule of the contract is where the detail of a particular player's remuneration goes. You know.
Lovely. Okay, that's good for anyone interested in the legal aspects. Obviously, we've got more on our website in respect to that. I've only got three questions left, Dick, but one thing that became interesting is, obviously, as an ad person, the Amex ended up sponsoring the stadium. Now, Amex are a worldwide brand. They probably didn't need it for brand awareness. How did the Amex become involved in...
I did that deal.
Oh, right, okay.
I did that deal in June 2008, which is before I stood down. In May 2009, but more significantly, it was before the worldwide credit crunch.
Fantastic.
In the autumn of 2008.
Of course, they're tied in for the duration.
I did this deal because I'm a marketing man.
Yeah.
I understood about big corporations and the need for them to demonstrate corporate social responsibility, right? So it was like the stars aligned perfectly as far as I was concerned. And it wasn't anything to do with the fact that Amex had their European headquarters in Brighton. It was nothing to do with that. What it was that I always intended, and go back to my development of Albion in the community, I always intended the stadium to be the community stadium. That was often the when we registered the original name of it, it was the community stadium, right? So I put together this proposal for Amex because I knew someone who knew the boss of Amex, right? Although I never had it as an account in my agency, but we had that type of company, global. I mean, my biggest client was Nissan, you know, so we had huge companies. I knew how to deal with these sort of companies. I put together this basic presentation, which was showing American Express how you use the power of sport in a community. And it's not just, because I come from the world of 30-second TV commercials, but it isn't just about taking 30-second TV commercials. It's about community dialogue at that level. People into the community aspect of it. That was the point, that you can reach communities. You know, their objective, American Express have four key missions. First of all, it's to their shareholders. Secondly, it's to their customers. Thirdly, it's to their staff. And fourthly, is to their communities.
Yeah.
Right? So I knew this, and I geared the whole of this stadium presentation not about Brighton being, you know, put your name on our football shirt, because he would have thrown me out. We were in League One. Mm. It was about the stadium, and it had to be the American Express. At the end of this one meeting that I had, which basically clinched it, and then he's put it on hold. He said, he told me about the worldwide credit crunch coming. And he said, we're going to have to put this deal on ice for at least 2 years. You know, you've got my, he shook me by the hand, but he said, you've got the deal. So what, you know, so basically I sold the concept of a community stadium as a way for a big corporation to deal at a beneficial level to the community in the communities it served. Mm. So he just loved it because it was absolutely met the mission for. And so many people, clubs have asked me to advise them, how the hell did you do the American Express deal? Because we were in League One. And I said, one thing you do is you don't try and get them to put their name on your shirt because you'll have maybe a minute of the meeting before they throw you out.
Yeah.
It's only when we went to the Premiership that they wanted to have, you know, we were able to sell them the name on the shirt then because it's global television. Mm. But it's, you know, it was never, in League One it's not global television. So I never went anywhere near the shirt as far as the first, when I did that deal. Yeah. Subsequently, you know, my successors took that deal on, obviously, because once we were in the Premier League, it was worth putting it to American Express that they, you know, they should put their name on our shirt.
It's certainly inspiring for anyone that's in business, such as us as well. It's know your client, know your customer. Know who you're selling to, know what your client does, yeah, you know need what your to customer
know,
does.
You need to know almost more about your client than they do.
Absolutely.
Because you need to be able to, in advertising, you need to be able to surprise them with, it's like Wonder Bra. You know, and it's not the same with you because you have to be, work within a very, you know, tight sort of grid of what's possible and what isn't possible. But in advertising, as long as it's legal and decent and honest, you know, you could. I used to have a slogan that said, you know, our job is this is worth, you know, our job is to give our clients on time and on cost what they never believed they needed until they saw it and then they realised they needed it all along.
Absolutely. I love that. That's fantastic.
Isn't it? When you think about it, and you know, there was a famous Northern architect who came out with that. A guy who was very, I can't remember his name now, but I remember reading a speech that he'd given, and he said this to the Royal Architectural Society or something, and it fitted my ad agency perfectly. And I said to the guys, we're going to use that as a slogan because it's perfect. You know, it's no good giving something brilliant if then it's going to... Oh, by the way, sorry, you know that fee I said of £1,000? It's £28,000. There's no point.
No.
You know, you've got to do it within the limitations of what the budget is and the time constraint.
No, brilliant. That's great advice for anyone in business, actually. Dick, you sold your shares to the fans, or you were in the process of selling your shares to the fans?
The club stopped me doing that.
But I mean, it's a very admirable thing to do. But what's the legacy you wish to leave behind if you wanted to just have a minute to, you know, or a couple of minutes to set out what legacy you'd like to leave behind for your time? And
what you mean as the Albion? You mean?
Yeah, at the Albion.
Well, I think I've left my legacy because I think, you know, most people, certainly of a certain, you know, 30 plus age group, know that probably if it wasn't for me, we wouldn't have a club, let alone a stadium. So I'm very determined, you know, and I'm very never say die sort of thing. I was absolutely determined to win that battle, A, against Archer, and he used to call me all sorts of names and, you know, the Chancer and, you know, a soft southern bastard, you know, because he was from Lancashire or something, and he looked down on people from the south of England. You know, you must be a softie because you're from Brighton. Oh, really? That I never, ever gave up. I'm determined, and when I set my heart on doing something, you know, I'm really quite persuasive. And I would hang on. He thought he could get rid of me. He thought he would see me off, as he said. And he didn't. And in the end, he gave up, you know. So I would say my legacy, without a doubt, that was only the start because I injected some money into the club then. But what was the most important thing was to revitalise everyone in the club, you know, because they all walked around with long faces. And there weren't that many because they'd been laid off, you know, loads of people were laid off. There was no motivation there at all. They were all came in with long faces, couldn't get out of the place quickly enough. And that was the players as well. They were just, you know, there was a feeling of doom around it. And I came from the advertising world where I built this really lively company where everyone enjoyed coming to work. So I made sure that people came to work and enjoyed it, you know. And so those motivations were all about re-infusing the club. And of course, I got the fans on board. So they knew that I was one of them. And so my legacy was around saving the club, but it was also putting the club on the right lines. I mean, I won the battle for the stadium, let's face it. I mean, Tony came along, and of course, we would have funded it because we had borrowings, and the American Express deal was, in terms of collateral, if you got American Express as a partner in the stadium, that's a very strong partner to have. Yeah,
absolutely. Dick, thanks so much. I've got a final question from Dan Tester. I think you know Dan. He said he's you're his hero. He's what he said to me yesterday when I messaged him. He just asked, what's it like to be a fan now? And how's that full circle come about?
Oh, I love that. It's a great question, Dan. He will know what I mean because for me, I go with the fans to the away games because I go to a lot of away games still and I always go where the fans are. So I always have lots of chats with them. But what is lovely is the fact that so many Albion fans are just appreciating that we're actually in the Premier League. So you go to these big grounds, you know, the Emirates or Spurs ground or Anfield, and you're actually there watching our team play these famous teams. And that is just wonderful. You know, and I was doing a BBC Radio 5 podcast about three months ago, and the guy, the interviewer, said, what was your best moment ever, you know, as a Brighton fan? And Brighton, you know, in your time with Brighton. So he was obviously thinking when I was a chairman. It was actually 3 months ago at the Emirates. When we beat Arsenal fair and square in a league game at their ground, and we were the better team. We deserved to win the game.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and I said, that is my dream. The idea that we would one day, when I took over at the Goldstone at that terrible time, when everyone was, you know, doom-laden, the club was dying, it was dead on its feet, to think that we, you know, playing Arsenal in the cup is one thing, but playing them in the league and outplaying them, Arsenal, because it was my second team, you know, it was my wife's team, all of her family, Gooners, there's Liam, who's one of the most famous Arsenal players ever. There's a big picture of him at the stadium, you know, outside. Yeah. So that was and the guy said, amazing. Not one of the times when you were chairman. I said, yes, it all was leading to this, what happened a few months ago.
Lovely.
Because we would never have, the idea that we would actually go to the Emirates, beat Arsenal, fair and square, you know, and I don't know if you saw that game, but, we were the better team, weren't we? We deserved to win. And then we came here and beat them here as well.
Yeah, it was a double over Arsenal, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, for me, Liam phoned me up. He sent me a text saying, so you finally got your wish, Mr. Knight, Mr. Chairman.
What invaluable 6 points as well, and in a big scheme of things.
Well, in the end, it saved us going down.
Yeah, it did.
But then, you know, that is the point about the pyramid, why the pyramid has to stay. It has to be maintained at all costs. Because it's the lifeblood of the game to have that tension. Imagine if all you do is, no matter how bad you are, you're not going to get relegated. That's what happens in the NFL. And then the only consolation if you come bottom is they give you the draft pick of the college players next season.
It's boring.
mean, I don't. I quite like the NFL. I mean, my daughter lives in Philadelphia, and you know, her family, her husband is English. They're, you know, but they went there and started a business there, which has been very successful. And the Eagles, the Philadelphia Eagles, are a great team. Mm. And I've been to see them loads of times, but it's still, doesn't matter how good they are. I mean, it's nice to win the Super Bowl, but, you know, mid-table, well, you're not mid-table because you're in the various regional league, but it's boring.
Never go down. They'll never have that last day of the season. Are you going to stay up or not?
Exactly.
Drama.
Or the other side of that. Look at the euphoria in this town when we won promotion to the Premier League. Yeah. Do you remember? I mean, the seafront was packed. You know, there was 250,000 people on the seafront. The team bus came along.
Amazing. Dick, thank you so much for today. I've really enjoyed it. It's my favourite podcast, I think. And some amazing stories and anecdotes and memories. And I think what I'm going to take from all this is enthusiasm. As long as you infuse people and get them infused, and you've won 50% of the battle, as you said at the start. So thank you so much.
Hello, you lovely people. Just to note that this is a podcast and does not constitute legal advice. Should you require any specific legal advice based on anything, then please contact your solicitor, or even better, us, and we can advise you fully.